Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with half of the United States Senate grilling the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, for most of the day today as he tried to deflect criticism and contrition with vague promises to reform his company's business model of surveillance capitalism in which the user is the product. Matt Stoller, a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who was recently a senior advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, joins us to discuss his article at the Daily Beast with Sarah Miller, Facebook Can't Be Fixed, It Needs to Be Broken Up. We will look into what appears to be the first challenge to the culture of impunity which Silicon Valley has enjoyed in a perfect, unregulated libertarian world that transcends nation states, out of which the world's richest and most powerful companies have been built in part on monetizing the abuse of citizens' privacy. With regulations now emerging in Europe, which Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft oppose, we will assess whether the Senate will force Mark Zuckerberg to deliver on his promises in a meaningful way. Then we will speak with Frances Brown, a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Democracy and Rule of Law program. She recently served on the White House National Security Council staff under Presidents Obama and Trump and joins us to discuss her op-ed at The Hill, If Trump Wants to Defeat ISIS, America Must Stabilize Syria, and Trump's threats to make Russia, Iran, and Assad pay a price in Syria. Threats which have been met by a counter-threat from the head of the Russian military that if the U.S. attacks Syrian government facilities, Russia will fire back with the Russian armed forces taking, quote, retaliatory measures against both missiles and their carriers. Then finally, we'll examine the fallout from the FBI's raid on Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, and the admission by the White House today that Trump believes he has the power to fire Robert Mueller. Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, The Cohen Raid is a Game Changer. Trump's reaction tells us so. And the extraordinary claim Trump made that the FBI raid was, quote, an attack on our country, when the opposite is true. It is Trump who is attacking the rule of law in America. And joining us now is Matt Stoller, who is a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who is currently writing a book on monopoly power in the 20th century. Previously, he spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. In addition to his work on The Hill, he has produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand, and he has an article at The Daily Beast with Sarah Miller, Facebook Can't Be Fixed, It Needs to Be Broken Up. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Stoller.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Matt. And what did you make of this extraordinary number of senators, almost half the Senate, grilling Mark Zuckerberg for most of the day today? The one bit that stood out for me was the Senator Kennedy, the Republican of Louisiana, saying to Zuckerberg, "Your user agreement sucks." What got your attention?
Well, so I Senator Kennedy really knows how to do Q&A. I think, you know, broadly speaking, you know, if you look at where we are from a historical context, I mean, we haven't really dealt with concentrations of power, monopoly power, like Facebook in at least 40 years, since the early 80s. And so really trying to understand what this thing is, this multinational, data-intensive, monopolistic ad company, and the changes that it's organized in our society, we don't even have the language to do that. So what we're seeing are a series of conversations, and this is just the latest, maybe the most important one so far, but it's a series of conversations that are oriented around the basic question of how do you fit Facebook into our democracy? And it was clumsy, and it was weird, and it was a little bit discouraging, but it's all based on this kind of really, really big problem and the rejuvenation of some muscles we haven't used in decades.
Well, as I mentioned in the opening, they have enjoyed a kind of libertarian perfect world, have they not, in Silicon Valley, unchallenged, the world's biggest corporation. What about 10 years ago, it was ExxonMobil that was the number one company in the world, and now it's Alphabet, Google, and Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft. So if they become that powerful in such a short period of time, one would assume in another 10 years they'll be taking over the world if they haven't already done that.
Well, I think the way you have to look at these companies is that they are actually private governments. So if you look at Zuckerberg, he's actually said this. He says, we're more like a government than a company. We set policies. They govern the social media space. Google governs your access to information on the internet. Apple kind of governs your access to your phone, what's on your phone. And, you know, Amazon governs the online retail experience and a whole series of other areas. And that's really the breakdown of our traditional anti-monopoly framework that existed until the 1970s, where we said, look, you know, there's only one government and it's elected. And if a company gets too powerful, we break it up. Because if we don't, then that company will, in fact, start to govern us directly. And that's what's happening. And so, look, we haven't really dealt with this problem for 40 years. Like, there hasn't been any awareness of this old intellectual tradition, but now there is. And, you know, it's going to take some time before people start to understand that. But the thing about these four companies that you mentioned, it's really Google, Facebook, and Amazon, is that they were born into a legal context where monopoly was basically fine and encouraged by the laws. So in the 80s, you saw companies like Walmart explode. You saw a whole series of monopolies formed through mergers and acquisitions. Then you saw a technological revolution in the 90s and 2000s. And then these companies are the first sort of digital native monopolies. They were born into a legal context. And now we're actually confronting the full force and power of both this remarkable digital revolution and this remarkable political revolution of the 80s, all of which have created our kind of new governing class. And I think it's going to take some time. I think we'll get there, but it's going to take some time before people start to understand that either we, the people, govern our society, or we will be governed by these monopolists and the political actors that they kind of hire or use.
Well, there was a moment in today's hearing before the Senate where Senator Lindsey Graham says to Zuckerberg, you don't think you have a monopoly?
And Zuckerberg said, you know, it doesn't feel like a monopoly. And there was another question where Senator Cruz said, you know, are you a neutral information platform because you discriminate? And he mentioned a bunch of conservatives. But, you know, what he was basically pointing at was the notion that Facebook pretends it's a neutral communications technology, but in fact has enormous amounts of discriminatory power. And I'm not a Republican and I don't support Senator Cruz, but the premise there is right. Like, Facebook is sitting in the middle of all of our interactions and he's picking and choosing the information that goes through based on what's good for Facebook. And that wouldn't be such a problem if Facebook weren't a monopoly, if it had bought these other social networks, if it didn't lock in its users, and if it didn't, you know, use its position as an essential communications facility to discriminate and sell advertising to manipulate us. But it does do that. And so, you know, you saw Senator Booker talk about the actual use of the platform to create discriminatory advertising campaigns around housing and credit. You saw Senator Graham talk about monopoly, Senator Cruz talk about neutrality discrimination, Senator Kennedy talking about, everybody talked about privacy violations. It was all clumsy. It was all a little bit weird. But that's because we don't necessarily have the language yet. But I was kind of like discouraged in the immediate heat of the moment, short term. It's like I wanted someone to go, you know, really nail them. But, you know, each senator had 4 minutes, not enough time. And I am encouraged by this broader conversation that we're having about what these institutions mean and how we should organize our society, whether we want these, you know, the most brilliant, powerful people in our society focused entirely with this remarkable technology on how to get us to click on ads, or whether we want to do something else. So that's a really interesting and set of questions, and I think we're going to get there.
Well, I must say, when Senator Cruz went on about a pervasive bias and political censorship against conservatives by Facebook, I thought that was a bit rich. And, of course, Zuckerberg then acknowledged that Silicon Valley is an extremely left-leaning place. Well, hello. What about the biggest outside investor in Facebook, Peter Thiel, the owner of Palantir? PayPal, he said that competition is for losers. I mean, And the other thing that's really pretty rich is that it was the conservatives, and we don't even know who it was, that rolled Zuckerberg early in the 2016 campaign by saying that Facebook, its curation of the news, where three-quarters of Americans get their information, was left-leaning, and they folded. And instead of using human curators, they switched to algorithms, which Cambridge Analytica and Jared Kushner, Stephen Bannon, the Mercers, et cetera, immediately gamed with fake news, which was amplified by Russian bots. That is the whole sorry history. And now we're learning that 87 million people were influenced by, their data from Facebook was given over to Cambridge Analytica. So I found...
That's all true, and that's all important. And what it speaks to is a question of who regulates our social discourse. And what you're saying is that some very scary people structure how we interact with each other and what political information we have and how we have our political conversations. And I agree with you. And I think we need to do something about that. And I think we need to have that explicit conversation. But it is a good conversation to have, and it's a different conversation to have than the one we were having a few years ago around, say, Citizens United, when people were saying, oh, I don't think money is speech. What they really were saying is, I don't think billionaires should be able to structure the way we talk to each other about politics just because they have more money. Well, now it's much more explicit because you got one guy, right, actually structuring how we engage in political speech. And so the question is no longer, are we going to have campaign finance rules? The question is now, is Mark Zuckerberg going to organize our campaign finance rules, or is we the people? Right. And that's the question that's the conversation that we should be having, not this kind of fake conversation that we've been having for 30, 40 years about all this nonsensical stuff about whether money is speech. No, now the raw power is on the table, so we can actually have the conversation. But I will note that it wasn't the Democrats who were coming at Mark Zuckerberg for having a lot of political and economic power. It was the Republicans who were doing it. So, you want to talk about who really understands political economy? I mean, they may not be on the right side. At least I don't think they're always on the right side. But the Republicans were the ones who were attacking the place that Mark Zuckerberg makes his $40 billion a year. So that's a good thing. That means that there is potential for bipartisan action here. So I'm pretty encouraged. And there's a lot of reasons to be pessimistic about where the world is going. But this conversation is really important. And we're now finally having it.
Well, just in closing, though, Matt Stoller, do you think that there will be an awakening on the part of the consumers, the users of Facebook, because essentially you don't get anything for free in this life, and if you get Gmail for free, you don't realize how much you're being targeted by advertising, and everything you write is being watched by some algorithm. And of course, Facebook has taken it much further in a much more personal direction, where the user is the product. So we get nothing out of being monetized. You'd think that's sort of taking your blood and out without telling you. I don't understand why people aren't a little uncomfortable, if not outraged, by that reality.
Well, they are uncomfortable, and I think there's a really important part of our intellectual tradition that has been lost, and the trick that was played on us in the 1970s and 80s to get us to stop thinking about our political rights was to transform who we are from citizens into consumers. That word consumer, if I could just say, we should never use that word when we're talking about core political issues, because this is not just about whether we are getting something for the service we're using. We are also producers. We all produce information. And there are a lot of people that are in the media business or that are in various types of businesses that need Facebook and use Facebook as a platform for how they produce, for how they work, for how their wages are set, for a whole set of things that don't involve, for how they do engage in political discourse, that are not consumer oriented. I may not even have a Facebook account, but how our politics is structured is a choice that Mark Zuckerberg can make that affects me as a citizen. So I would say, is there a consumer revolt? You can't really revolt. Facebook owns, the social networking space. But is there a citizen revolt against what they're doing? I think absolutely. I think people are saying enough. we want to live in a democracy. We don't like the power that you have over us, and we're going to do something about that. And this is the process of that actual revolt happening. So, yes, it's happening now.
Well, Matt Stoller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Stoller, who's a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who is currently writing a book on monopoly power in the 20th century. Previously, he spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. In addition to his work on the Hill, he has produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand. And he has an article at the Daily Beast with Sarah Miller, "Facebook Can't Be Fixed, It Needs to Be Broken Up." We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's threats to make Russia, Iran, and Assad pay a price in Syria, threats which have been met by counter threats from the head of the Russian military.
100%. A don't get error. Be careful with the downloading. Protect your eyes. Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay.
بالقلم اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Francis Brown, who is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Democracy and Rule of Law program. With 15 years as a practitioner and analyst at the intersection of conflict and governance, she most recently served as director for democracy on the White House National Security Council staff in the Obama and Trump administrations. And she has an op-ed at The Hill, "If Trump wants to defeat ISIS, America must stabilize Syria." Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Brown.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Frances. And it appears that we are poised not to stabilize Syria, but to attack Syria. This has led to the Russians, including the Chief of General Staff, Valery Gerasimov, who has warned that Russia will fire back if the U.S. attacks Syrian government facilities, saying that if a threat to our servicemen emerges, the Russian armed forces will take retaliatory measures against both missiles and their carriers, which would mean if we fire cruise missiles from the two Ali-class destroyers out in the Mediterranean, the Russians might well attack the ships. So that's a pretty serious threat. It's led the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to say that he is alarmed that Russia and the United States are on the verge of a confrontation. So what's your reading on where we stand?
Well, yes, indeed. It would certainly be a tremendously concerning development if we were to see an escalation. I mean, I think it's important to remember that the Russians and the U.S. do have very, very sophisticated deconfliction mechanisms. So our military professionals on the ground are no doubt taking all of these issues into account. But I do think the broader point that you raise is a really concerning one. I think we could be headed to some kind of escalation in Syria. It's no secret that John Bolton, the new national security advisor who just began work yesterday in the Trump White House, does have a penchant for military instruments of power. It does seem like he mirrors the president's penchant in that regard. So you could very easily see a way in which, as they weigh options, the military option seems like the likeliest one. My understanding, just from press reports, is that these meetings are ongoing. There's multiple options that have been presented to the national security team. So we'll see where it goes, but I agree with you. It could be a very troubling escalation.
Well, I would be concerned that the president has stuck his neck out. He always prefaces his threats and posturing with saying how weak Obama was and how Obama caved on his red line and that he would not do that. And he mentioned that he didn't do it the last time about a year ago when there was a chemical attack and the U.S. fired 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian air base. So since he has said that Assad, as he called animal Assad, will pay a big price, and the enablers of Assad, which he specified, Russia and Iran, would also pay a price. So can he back down from those threats, given now that the Russians are saying, if you start any kind of serious attack on the Syrian government and their installations, we're going to retaliate because we have our people in those installations?
Yeah, you're right. It's always remarkable how President Trump seems to view his number one enemy or his number one adversary as whatever President Obama did, and seems to need, now he's been in office more than a year, seems still to need to show how he's different and better from Obama. And I think as we think through the gas attack last year, as you say, almost exactly a year ago, it seemed to be very purposefully to show that he wasn't Obama and that he wasn't afraid of using force. It seems that he does connect this to the idea that this is showing that he's a tough guy, showing he's unafraid. But when you're thinking about his reputation, or when we're thinking about his reputation, we have to wonder, what did that strike get him or get us? Did it really scare anybody? I think from Assad's perspective, it demonstrated to Assad that Trump was willing to do one strike, but then because he's the attention deficit disorder president, you know, moved on to other things. So I'm not really sure if there was any deterrent effect from that last strike. I furthermore think if Assad were watching the situation, he would probably wonder if Trump would really stick to his proverbial guns this time around either. Assad might think he could wait out one attack or sort of one round of missile strikes, and that then Trump would be on to the next preoccupation, be it North Korea or something else. So I think it's clear that Trump thinks a lot about his reputation, and he thinks about that in military terms, but I'm not really sure that he's got the discipline or the longevity of purpose to actually make anything change on the ground in Syria.
Well, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, who, by the way, are investigating the nerve gas attack in the UK, are going to send a team in. The Russians have already said they sent their people into Douma, where the latest chemical attack apparently happened. They said there was nothing there, nothing to it. Of course, we've all seen the footage of these young kids barely able to breathe, so, and many of them dead. So something happened there. So when you look at that threshold, using weapons of mass destruction and flouting international norms, surely something has to be done to send Putin a message that he can't keep getting away with it.
Well, I think this is certainly something that it appears right now the UN Security Council is weighing and debating. I believe that vote is maybe underway or just concluded, and I certainly wouldn't presume to know what the result of the full OPCW report will bring, but I do think that this is something that Trump's national security team is probably seized with right now, between UN Ambassador Nikki Haley and then the new team in Washington. I do think in terms of how this will unfold, there will be a very different decision-making process from the U.S. side under John Bolton. John Bolton is not known to be a sort of a fair, honest broker of decision-making in the way that national security advisors historically have been. We know that Bolton comes with his own preferences for military power and is unlikely to sort of weigh all the options. Meanwhile, we've got Secretary Tillerson, who was by most accounts very bad on personnel and organization, but a moderating influence on policy. He's obviously gone, and Secretary-designate Pompeo is under confirmation hearings this week. He seems to be a much more hawkish policy thinker. And finally, we just heard today that Tom Bossert, the former Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor to the President, has been asked to resign as well. So it's a totally different mix, and I think how that will play out in terms of the U.S. response, what is to be done, remains to be seen, but you can certainly envision a way in which this new group of policymakers feels that they want to respond forcefully.
Well, at the UN, surely whatever happens, Russia would veto. That's all they've done all along, haven't they? That's why there's never been any way to constrain Assad and why he is so brazen and so bold. So that's fairly predictable. So that wouldn't that just reduce the UN Security Council down to a kind of hand-wringing, debating society?
Yeah, you could see a sort of a very diluted action coming out of that. And I believe I saw preliminary reports coming out saying Russia did veto, and I believe China abstained. Russia's got its own resolutions to table. I do not know the details. But yes, you're right. We've sort of been down this road multiple times before with various permutations, and we sort of know where it lands.
So if the hawks are gathering and there isn't, by the way, at the sort of meltdown that Trump had yesterday where he was surrounded by all the generals, there was nobody from the State Department there. They, as you mentioned, Tillerson has gutted the place. So there's nothing in terms of diplomacy sitting at the table. Of course, Trump was going on about what happened to his private lawyer, the FBI raid, and he was displaying a certain amount of unhinged fury. But then apparently they got to work. So I think what was pretty clear to me from looking at the all the brass at the table there was that there's a huge deficit in diplomacy.
Yeah, you've hit it on the head. I think when we think about U.S. tools of power, diplomacy basically suffers from two problems right now. One is bandwidth, and the other is champions. In terms of bandwidth, the State Department's been gutted. I think there's now 38 ambassadorships that are still open, myriad high-level assistant secretary positions. It's really a shadow of itself, unfortunately. And then there's a lack of champions. We had Secretary Tillerson, who frequently undercut his own departments and willingly took a 30% budget cut, seemed like he had no affirmative agenda for what he wanted diplomacy to achieve in service of U.S. foreign policy. He just wanted to get in line with the White House's staff cuts and budget cuts. So now the result of that, after 15 months of the Trump administration, is that you're right, as key options are being weighed for a major decision like Syria, all of the people discussing are within the military, and I would probably suspect the intelligence world as well. So those are, when all you've got is a hammer, of course everything looks like a nail, and I think we're seeing a very vulnerable time. The State Department does have an acting secretary, Deputy Secretary John Sullivan, but he probably doesn't feel that he's got the top cover or, again, bandwidth to really stick his neck out in this way. I believe he will now be traveling to Latin America in place of or along with Vice President Pence on the trip that the president was going to. So, yes, the brass is all lined up, and I think diplomatic champions and diplomatic bandwidth are really hard to come by. And this is certainly something I felt as a staffer when I was there during the early months of the Trump administration.
So what do you think is happening in terms of how the Russians see it? Because it's pretty clear that Putin pushes the envelope, as does Assad, and the U.S. has largely been passive. And in fact, Donald Trump has been mysteriously compliant, if not in some weird collusion. We don't know that. That's what their special counsel is looking into. But he's been basically given Putin a pass until very recently, where he finally spoke out. But just a week before that, he was talking about pulling the U.S. out altogether. And many people see that as strategic malpractice, given that there's only 2,000 U.S. troops there astride the land route between Damascus and Tehran. Also, they're occupying the oil fields, which Assad, of course, wants back. The idea that you would give up that chip for nothing apparently has alarmed the Israelis. And that's another issue, surely, Francis, in the sense that at the end of the day, it seems almost inevitable that a conflict between Israel and Iran is looming as Iran trains up some of the Arab Shia militias from Iraq to send them into Syria. That's a red line for the Israelis. So this is a complicated situation, but let's just deal with the accusation of strategic malpractice, the idea that the U.S. would suddenly pull out and give up that important chip without getting anything in return.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, I think from the Russian standpoint and from Assad's standpoint, they're probably seeing both U.S. lack of coherence in terms of strategy and lack of commitment. And the president made that both of those very clear last week when he sort of randomly, as you say, announced that the troops were coming home, this very small number of troops were coming home very soon, while the campaign to defeat ISIS has not even completed. And as we all know from history, just even a territorial defeat of ISIS doesn't mean they've been defeated for all of eternity. They could very easily reconstitute. So it took, as we know, his top generals by surprise. It certainly took his national security team by surprise. There was a lot of effort during the second half of the week to sort of roll back those comments and make it sound like it was part of a broader strategic and coherent plan, but I think we'd be hard-pressed to find it. I do agree, I think, giving up that swath of land, that important swath of land, which is one of the few secure and stable parts of Syria that are just not under the Assad regime, that would be strategic malpractice without a codified diplomatic plan for how this gains us more bargaining chips and bringing an end to this devastating conflict. It would sort of be a grand bargain for nothing from Trump's perspective. And for the ultimate deal maker, which Trump views himself as, it's really mystifying why he would give this up. It seems that he may backtrack and he may change his mind on the troop levels. An additional aspect that I'm very focused on is the civilian component of this, figuring out how some kind of durable civilian service delivery and demining effort can be sustained after the military campaign. Trump obviously has no interest in that, but perhaps under Pompeo, at least someone will speak up for the civilian side of the house. I have to say it's a very befuddling turn of events, and I don't see a strategic logic to any of these announcements over the last week.
Well, particularly given how much Trump has trumpeted how he, again, attacking Obama, his predecessor, saying how he's really tougher on ISIS and he's going to wipe them out. The idea that you would allow them to come back at the same time, basically hang out the Kurds to dry, who are the only reliable boots on the ground that the U.S. has actually worked with. I mean, the Kurds were betrayed before by Henry Kissinger, but they would be slaughtered, would they not, if the U.S. air power pulled out? The Turks are attacking them, and the Iranians, and Assad and the Russians would also attack them. So,
Yeah, I mean, the Kurd partnership is absolutely a big consideration here, and I think we need to think even beyond the Kurds. The Trump administration has said that they want to have a more cost-effective foreign policy. They want to outsource certain activities to other partners. The Kurds, and specifically the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a Kurdish Arab force, they were in some ways a model of that kind of partnership. They were a tremendously effective fighting force. They held a lot of territory. This should be the dream that the U.S. under Trump wants to work with. But if it becomes clear that this is how the U.S. treats its partners, that it hangs them out to dry after using them to clear territory that, frankly, the Kurds were not as interested in clearing to begin with, I think that'll send a real message to other potential partners that the U.S. might want to have elsewhere in the world on other counterterrorism missions. So, again, it's a real strategic blunder to backtrack on this. And if this is how the U.S. treats its partners, I think that's going to be heard loud and clear for other would-be partner forces.
So, in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to your article at The Hill, Francis Brown. If Trump wants to defeat ISIS, America must stabilize Syria. And clearly, there's nothing underway to stabilize Syria at this point. It's just a question of when the Russian-Iranian victory takes place. And all along, the Russians and the Iranians have known what they want. And the problem, I think, on our side is we know what we don't want, but we don't know what we want. And now it may be too late to do much. Would there be, though, I recall years ago talking with Paul Nitzer about a strategy called geostrategic indigestion that was suggested during the time of Soviet expansion into Africa. And, of course, we were all hysterical about it. And some people inside the State Department policy planning staff said, well, let them take over. Let them take over as much territory as they want because it's just going to accelerate the end of the Russian Empire, which is what happened. So without being too cynical, if the Russians and the Iranians have a victory, then why not have a Pyrrhic victory? Let them take responsibility for reconstructing the country under this guy that President Trump calls Animal Assad.
Yeah, I understand that line of thought. I will say that from my perspective, and my Hill article was co-authored with my colleague Melissa Dalton, from our perspective, the Assad regime has historically been one of the biggest drivers of extremism. So the idea that Assad would reconstitute control over the entirety of the country and rebuild it and take on that responsibility, I think is unrealistic. I think instead we could see very easily see a reconstitution of an extremist group under some other moniker, perhaps. So from our perspective, yes, the U.S. has a lot of strategic incoherence, but we have been clear, at least Trump has been clear, that we do want to defeat ISIS. And defeat ISIS, in our view, means not just defeat ISIS until the midterm elections here in the United States, but instead in an enduring way, using a small amount of civilian funds to do so, and more importantly, showing U.S. leadership and a vision for what that SDF-held territory could and should look like, and then getting other multinational donors to sign on. That's the kind of leadership that historically the U.S. has been willing to show for issues that are close to our national interests, like the defeat of ISIS. So in that sense, we think it's a viable way forward, and it has been the way forward until the Trump, until President Trump flip-flopped last week. So we are still hopeful that perhaps this this can be brought to bear once Secretary Pompeo is in charge.
And basically, in some, you're suggesting that they took away $200 million, did they not, from the areas that have been cleared?
Precisely.
And that's the only part of Syria that's stable and is not either under Assad's control or in the middle of warfare.
There is a small so-called de-escalation area in the south near the Jordanian border, which sort of benefits from the Jordanians' watchful eye as well, but that is very tenuous as well. I would say that ceasefire is on a knife edge, particularly now. So, yes, it is the rare part of the territory that is stable, that life and commerce are beginning to return to. And after all that Syrians have gone through, I also think there is a moral obligation to at least think about the consequences of a full-on pullout from there.
Well, just in closing, though, it seems that what's in the cards with a Russian-Iranian Assad victory will be particularly where the last of the rebels have been transferred to Idlib province, that if they finally do a final kind of solution, to quote from the Nazis, won't that mean another massive exodus of refugees into Europe? That was what happened essentially when the Russians came in. Shortly after the Russians came in, there was that massive exodus through Turkey into Europe, and Sakyr, the head of NATO at the time, said that the Russians were weaponizing refugees. So that's another cynical card that Putin can play, is it not?
Yes, unfortunately it is. And this is where, again, we view the importance of Syrian refugees to return home. It's obviously important for ethical reasons. It's also in the national interest of the U.S. and our European allies to make sure that some parts of Syria could allow for a safe and stable return. And then, yeah, and finally, everything you say is dead on, and I would just add that if we know the logic of the conflict and where it's going, this is an existential conflict for Assad, enabled by his Iranian and Russian backers. It's very hard to see how the strikes that are being considered right now for the chemical weapons attack, how those strikes at all change the logic of the war. I don't see them at all shaping the outcome in a meaningful way. So I hope the president's national security team is thinking long and hard about that.
Well, Frances Brown, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Frances Brown, who's a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Democracy and Rule of Law program, with 15 years as a practitioner and analyst at the intersection of conflict and governance. She most recently served as director for democracy on the White House's National Security Council staff in the Obama and Trump administrations. And she has an op-ed at The Hill: if Trump wants to defeat ISIS, America must stabilize Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the fallout from the FBI's raid on Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, and the admission by the White House today that Trump believes he has the power to fire Robert Mueller. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk and the Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian: The Cohen Raid is a Game Changer. Trump's Reactions Tell Us So. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
Great to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. And it was an extraordinary day yesterday. And today, of course, is a big news day. I haven't been able to spend the whole day watching Zuckerberg testify before the Senate. But let's talk about what happened last night at this meeting where Trump had the war cabinet and all the generals were there. And he went off the deep end in a way that we haven't seen since the lobby of the Trump Tower, when he went off about how that the Nazis in Charlottesville were good people. And I think in both occasions, that's a glimpse into who he really is and what it's like 24/7 inside the White House, which is what we get from leaks, that they're dealing with a deranged individual who happens to be president of the United States. But the most frightening thing came out today in an inadvertent slip on the part of Sarah Sanders, the White House spokesperson, where she said that Donald Trump believes that he has the right and the power to get rid of Robert Mueller. So does that portend a constitutional crisis, which many have warned about?
I really don't see this president exiting office without dragging us through some kind of constitutional crisis. He seems to have just a kind of an astonishing disregard for the rule of law. Remember the great political thinker Hannah Arendt, she said something along the lines of democratic rulers, in contrast to authoritarian or dictatorial rulers, realize that there is a virtue in having institutions and persons with independent judgment. And that is a lesson that is aptly and completely lost on the President of the United States. It's really quite astonishing. So that if you're not loyal to him personally, then you are you have no place in his government. I mean, it's a fundamental disregard of basic norms of democracy. And, you know, whether he's deranged or not, again, I think I've said to you in the past, I'm not that keen on psychologizing, but what is unmistakably the case is the way in which he shows this kind of shocking contempt for our intelligence, law enforcement, and justice community. And it really does portend that we'll end up in some kind of constitutional crisis.
Well, when Trump said yesterday at the table with the generals, it's a disgrace, it's frankly a real disgrace, it's an attack on our country in a true sense, it's an attack on what we stand for. Well, Once again, the opposite is true. It's Donald Trump who is attacking the rule of law in America.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, that is exactly right. In fact, one of the things that, I guess it's almost kind of a parlor game that people could play, that you could take whatever statement that Donald Trump makes about someone else, turn it around, apply it to him, and suddenly you have a very truthful and insightful statement. So he does make these truthful and insightful statements simply by their negative or by turning them around 180 degrees.
But he has to bring up Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. It's just psychotic that he can't get his head around the idea that he's president of the United States, and he somehow keeps blaming them for these imaginary infractions on the part of Hillary Clinton. He went after his own attorney general for not investigating Hillary Clinton, talking about how guilty she is. Well, she's only guilty in his mind because he's the one who's brought up this stuff. But if his own attorney general can't have a special prosecutor look into Hillary Clinton, because as partisan as Jeff Sessions is and as supine as he is in serving his master, Donald Trump, Jeff Sessions, can't even find anything to go after Hillary with.
Yes, that's absolutely right, except, again, what looks like deranged and at very least, completely groundless and, to my mind, defamatory statements about people like Hillary Clinton, they would have no traction except that, in a kind of way that continues to disappoint and gobsmack, they get repeated by, his various minions at Fox News. I mean, I don't think the president would have any kind of traction in making these kinds of statements if he didn't have, people like Molly Hemingway appearing on Fox News, basically completely adopting and airing the president's own contempt for Mueller and his investigative team, arguing again that these people are not independent, that they're partisan, that they're engaged in some kind of conspiracy to remove them from office. I mean, that's the thing that seems to be so dangerous, that makes this such a dangerous moment for our democracy. It's not simply these astonishing statements coming from the president, but that they're given traction and they're given support by a news organization, or at least we'll put that in scare quotes, a news organization that enjoys a tremendous readership and viewership.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College, and he has an article at The Guardian, "The Cohen Raid is a Game Changer. Trump's Reaction Tells Us So." Well, of course, Fox and there's a book by Jerome Corsi out now about the deep state, and all that he's attacking now is the imaginary deep state and this conspiracy to take away his presidency, which his followers clearly believe. So how do you crack that nut or those nuts? Because you've got, in this case with Cohen, Rob Rosenstein apparently authorized it, and he's a Republican, a federal judge authorized the FBI raid and gave them the warrant, another Republican. The U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Manhattan, who also authorized the raid, is a Republican.
And a Trump appointee.
So where are the Democrats in the chain of this particular FBI raid?
Right. Exactly. Well, they're not really there. I mean, I suppose you could say that, the referral to the Southern District Prosecutor's Office in New York came from the Mueller investigation, and of course Mueller himself is a Republican, but as the people of Fox will hasten to remind us, other members of that Mueller team are Democrats. I mean, but the whole idea, I mean, these are obviously professionals. These are professionals who are engaged in some independent, nonpartisan investigation. It's clear that Trump's strategy is not a crazy strategy in a way. And again, this is why I sort of push back a bit on this notion that he's, just making deranged statements, because it's a very effective strategy to discredit the investigation. I mean, the best way to avoid any kind of condemning conclusions that would issue from the Mueller investigation is to discredit the investigation before it ever issues those conclusions. And that's what he's doing. And it's it's a scorched earth policy, and it's a policy which is, as you pointed out, as we've both said, is an attack on the rule of law in the United States. But it has its certain traction. And, you know, you look at the polls among Republicans, and there are a substantial number of Republicans who really already have voiced the opinion that they won't accept any conclusions that come out of this Mueller investigation.
Well, I think you're right to pull me over about using the word deranged, because it's not an accurate description of what I perceive, which is a trapped animal who is out of his depth, doesn't know what he's doing, pulls off daily stunts. This is government by stunt. He's always distracting, and unfortunately the press and the public do get distracted by his antics, and he's able to, and meanwhile the Republicans like Ryan and McConnell are enacting all kinds of reactionary laws and changing the very nature of governance in this country and destroying so many protections, and not to mention digging the U.S. deeper into debt. So there's a lot going on that we miss on a daily basis because Trump, and again, this is, I guess, is clever on his part, or desperate is another way to look at it. I look at it more in terms of desperation and more in terms of the fact that this guy knows he's completely unqualified and he's a flim-flam artist, and he's going to eventually run out of reality TV tricks, which is what he is. He's a reality TV president. So his main focus is to keep Ann Coulter and these right-wingers off his back so that they still stay aboard the delusion that he is not who he really is. But my sense is that when you've got a fraud and a huckster in charge of this country pulling off these daily government by stunts and reality TV presidency, isn't he going to eventually run out of material?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I'm as good at predicting the future as you are. Do I believe that Donald Trump will remain in office for his for a full first term? I do not. I don't know exactly what will remove him from office. It just seems that the level of incompetence and an active attack on American constitutional norms is so grave that it just seems intolerable for us to endure that for four full years. That said, you know, I'm not sure if he's going to run out of tricks. I mean, it just might be the case that that he discovers that American legal and constitutional institutions have a durability that even his amazing ability to kind of to attack them and to distract us from those attacks or to try to undermine the credibility of those institutions, that it just hit the wall at some point. That's the only thing that we can hope. We can hope that, you know, as opposed to someone like Erdogan in Turkey or someone Orban in Hungary, that American institutions demonstrated durability and a resilience that pushed back against this guy, because he's certainly trying to deform those institutions. And he has been, you know, in certain ways, very resourceful at doing that.
Well, he is clearly, though, behaving like a guilty man. I mean, it's just so manifestly clear, not, of course, to the Fox viewers, but it is clear that it's the same thing with Bill Clinton. Remember, he wagged his finger and I never had sex with that woman and whatever he said? Well, that was the actions of a guilty man, because an innocent man would have said, look, I've been wrongly accused by this young lady, and I really feel that we should sort of quieten down and not talk about it. Maybe she should seek some kind of counseling, because it's simply not true. That's what I think a innocent person. So we've been through the idea that presidents lie, and this was basically he's lying about a blowjob, for God's sake. This guy's lying about everything. Every day he lies and lies and lies. And if he were innocent, and if there was this question about the legitimacy of his presidency, he'd be the first to want to clear the air and get the Russian investigation out and get everything on the table. But instead, he's obfuscated and fought back, and now he's getting desperate as it closes in on him. So
yes, no, I agree completely about that. Absolutely. I mean, he certainly is behaving like a very guilty person, and he does act like a cornered animal. And it does look like he's just kind of flailing about in a sort of desperate fashion. You know, again, I think both of us, we just share the hope that that desperation doesn't bring down institutions and norms that are very dear to us, because he certainly hasn't shown any shame about trying to undermine, you know, these coordinate branches of government that you would think he'd be desperately trying to secure the allegiance of. You know, he seems to be thinking that as long as these people aren't paying aren't being loyal to me specifically, then I will just try to tear them down. And I don't know. It's astonishing. I mean, you know, it's not a particularly insightful scholarly point, but it is an amazing thing to hear the President of the United States attacking the Justice Department, attacking the FBI, attacking the intelligence communities. And not just attacking them, as you pointed out, he makes use of the argument that they are engaged in an attack on the United States. Yeah. An astonishing thing to come out of the mouth of the President of the United States.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Douglas, you mentioned that you didn't think he would last a full term. And, of course, these midterms may bring about a blue wave and Democratic control of the House. And there's an expectation that they would begin impeachment. But in many ways, that's turning out to be the best campaign platform the Republicans have, which is you've got to keep us in because all the Democrats want to do is impeach this guy. They don't have a positive message. They just have this negative message that they want to just drag the country through another trial. And you've got this billionaire out there, Tom Steyer, on some bizarre ego trip, making these commercials calling for impeachment, which is completely stupid as far as I can tell as a strategy. Surely the Democrats should run on a positive message that they're going to fix things. And furthermore, just let the deep state, if you want to use Trump's term for the law and order in this country, let them take care of this corrupt and dangerous ignoramus who might well have been put into the Oval Office by Vladimir Putin.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, it's a funny kind of thing that this idea that it's the Democrats who aren't going to be arguing that, well, elect us because we will impeach him. It's the Republicans who are trying to argue that, oh, you have to elect us, lest their president be impeached. And, I think it's a self-defeating strategy to try to make the argument that the reason we deserve to be in office is because we're the ones who are going to take the president, we're going to remove him from office. I mean, not to say that he shouldn't be removed, but we should, of course, wait to see what the results of the Mueller investigation are, which I have every reason to believe will uncover, pretty dramatic examples and instances of malfeasance by the part of Trump, his corporation, all the members of the family. So, again, mm-hmm. I can only predict, but it seems that the Mueller investigation is doing a highly thorough job and that they have, I mean, every indication that we have received suggests that they've uncovered very important evidence.
Well, Lawrence Douglas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Douglas, Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College, who has an article at The Guardian, "The Cohen Raid is a Game Changer. Trump's Reaction Tells Us So." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.